WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the American militia movement and the politics of hate. We talk with Kenneth Stern, the American Jewish Committee's expert on hate and hate groups. 9 days before the Oklahoma City bombing, he issued a report warning that people associated with militias were poised to attack government officials. Stern has written a new book about the militias. Also today, we remember sculptor Dwayne Hansen, who died over the weekend at the age of 70. His lifelike sculptures of people are so lifelike, they're often mistaken for real people. And our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, reviews recordings of Mozart and Brahms sonatas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. GOP congressional leaders are criticizing President Clinton for vetoing their welfare reform plan. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says he doesn't claim the bill was perfect, but he says it would have put an end to a failed system. Mr. Clinton said the legislation did not do enough to get welfare recipients back to work by providing job training and education. The president says he wants to work with the Republicans to come up with a more acceptable version of the bill. The Postal Service says mail is moving smoothly again in the eastern U.S. after disruptions in 8 states from the blizzard that hit the region. Federal employees have been ordered to return to their jobs tomorrow after 3 days off from the snow, on top of the long furlough many of the workers had endured during the budget debate. At least 96 deaths are being attributed to the storm, and experts at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta are warning motorists in areas with deep snow to take precautions against carbon monoxide poisoning. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
The problem, according to the CDC, is that car exhaust pipes can easily be blocked by snow. Carbon monoxide from the exhaust then seeps back into the car, causing nausea, fatigue, chest pain, dizziness, and confusion, and sometimes death. So far, the CDC says, 2 dozen people in New York, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., and Maryland have been poisoned this way, and at least one has died. The agency recommends that before starting a car, check to make sure there's no snow in the tailpipe. Also, don't sit in an idling vehicle without cracking a window, and leave the car if you feel any symptoms. This is Joanne Solberner in Washington.
Virginia was one of the states hit hard by the blizzard. From Richmond, Deborah Abbey reports people there are looking toward the next storm system moving eastward.
1 to 3 feet of snow began to loosen its grip on the Commonwealth today. Interstate highways and major thoroughfares have been cleared, but many are still stuck in rural areas and subdivisions. On Friday, another storm is expected to bring sleet, freezing rain, and perhaps up to 4 more inches of snow. State emergency services workers are urging Virginians to prepare for the storm by stocking up now on food, medicine, and fuel. Snow removal has been a round-the-clock headache, and the storm has already cost the state $15 to $20 million. Among those struggling to get to work today were the state's legislators. The Virginia General Assembly convened at noon. For National Public Radio, this is Deborah Abbey reporting.
NASA is hoping the unseasonably cold weather in Florida will not cause problems for tomorrow's pre-dawn launch of the space shuttle Endeavour. The shuttlecraft and the launch pad are being heated to guard against any dangerous ice buildup. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is now down 78 points at 5,052 in heavy trading. In the over-the-counter market, the Nasdaq Composite Index is down 8.5 points. This is NPR News. Israel has begun releasing hundreds of Palestinian prisoners as part of its peace agreement with the Palestine Liberation Organization. Over the next 5 days, the total could reach 1,200 prisoners. The release comes less than 2 weeks before Palestinian elections and is expected to give a boost to PLO leader Yasser Arafat's standing. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is in Israel today on a visit designed to encourage progress toward a peace agreement between Israel and Syria. From Jerusalem, NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Shortly after his arrival in Jerusalem, Secretary of State Christopher urged Israel and Syria to accelerate the pace of their negotiations. The latest round of talks completed in Maryland last week ended without any major progress. The main sticking point remains the question of the Golan Heights, the strategic region Israel captured from Syria in 1967. Speaking to reporters in Jerusalem, Christopher said that negotiating a peace accord between Israel and Syria is one of his highest priorities.
Our objective is nothing less than to end Israel's conflict, not just with Syria, but with all of her Arab neighbors.
Secretary of State Christopher travels to Damascus tomorrow, where he'll meet with Syrian President Hafez al-Assad. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
A new study finds that many teen pregnancies might be averted if clinics counseled adolescent girls about birth control when the girls received negative pregnancy test results. Researchers studied data from almost 3,000 young women who asked for either take-home or in-house pregnancy tests. Of those who had conceived, over 34% had previously received a negative pregnancy test. Volvo may be the next European carmaker to open a plant in the U.S. The Wall Street Journal reports today the Swedish firm is considering building passenger cars and sport utility vehicles in North America and is discussing possible joint ventures with other automakers. Volvo has been building heavy trucks in North America in a joint venture with GM. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 9 days before the Oklahoma City bombing, Kenneth Stern, an expert on hate groups, issued a report on the militia movement. He warned that the movement was spreading and that it had all the ingredients which could lead to disaster: disaffection, conspiracy theories, violence, and documented ties to hate groups. Stern warned that people connected with militias were poised to attack government officials, possibly on April 19, 1995, the second anniversary of the conflagration in Waco. The report didn't get much attention until after his warning came to pass. Stern works for the American Jewish Committee, an organization dedicated to fighting bigotry. He's written a new book about the American militia movement and the politics of hate called A Force Upon the Plain. I asked him how the militias have reacted to the public scrutiny which followed the Oklahoma City bombing.
There are a couple of militia groups that closed up shop after April 19th. There are a couple that basically decided it wasn't politically correct to call themselves militias anymore. There's one up in Orange County, New York, that decided it was going to call itself a committee of correspondence. And a reporter friend of mine went to a meeting there shortly after April 19th, and he was chuckling in the aftermath of that meeting because occasionally people would forget. So he said it's like that old Cheech and Chong skit, you know, that we're not a gang, we're a club. So there are some that have decided to call themselves something different. But basically, the shared perception of the people that monitor the movement is that it has grown since April 19th. And if you think about it, that's not terribly surprising because people are attracted to the militia movement not because they want to join some sort of radical group, or decide they want to take on government. What they're doing is they're finding mainstream issues, be it gun control, environmental issues in the West, to a lesser extent, abortion, government intrusiveness. These are sort of mainstream issues, and they're attracted, to these groups because of those concerns. So those concerns remain, the attractions remain, and therefore the groups are likely to grow. I mean, one friend of mine in Montana has a very good metaphor that I use in the book about the militia movement, saying that it's like a funnel moving through space, and at the wide end, there is a these mainstream issues, and that the further in you get start getting these conspiracy theories and the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. And the further down in the funnel you get where all these crazy conspiratorial ideas swirl around, out pops somebody like a Timothy McVeigh or a Terry Nichols.
So at the wide end of the funnel, the place where people are sucked in, those issues are what, gun control, what else?
Gun control, environmental issues. I'm going to give you an example, one that I use in the book again. It's a little town called Chehalis, Idaho, which, to give you an idea of what life is like there, they sell a T-shirt that says, end of the earth, 12 miles, Chehalis 15. And there are five national forests in the region. Almost every job is dependent on the forest, either for the two mines in the area or for grazing. There was a suit brought by the Sierra Club that said that some plan did not adequately, under the Environmental Protection Act, consider the impact on salmon. Well, this is 900 miles upstream from the Pacific Ocean. It's probably theoretically possible that a salmon could swim so far, but nobody actually remembers one doing so. And here you had a lawsuit brought by people in San Francisco, ruled on by a judge who was sitting in Hawaii based on a law passed in Washington. And there was a real fear that there was a temporary injunction going to be issued in March of 1995, which basically would have had the impact of a bomb on the entire community, that its economy would have been gone. That was an organizing dream for the local militia, and they even had state officials coming and addressing rallies with the militia members and leaders talking about the need to protect Idaho's sovereignty. So that's an extreme example, but you could understand how folks in that type of community see the federal government as trying to impact their daily lives through environmental laws.
You write in your book that the militias have expanded faster than any hate group in history, and one of the reasons why is the Internet. How did the militias, particularly in the early stage, use the Internet?
Well, this is an easy way of transferring information. They decided clearly that if you're in a little community and you're isolated, for a local phone call, you can share information back and forth relatively easily. It also creates this sort of community in a way. I mean, if you look at people that have talked about hate group activity, there's a community aspect of why people join. On the Internet, there's sort of a de facto community of people that have the same values. Also, the rumor potential of the Internet. You can't really tell whether the information you're getting is credible or junk. The conspiracy theories run wild in the militia movement, and the Internet is, I think, a very good conduit for rumor mongering and conspiracy theories.
The Simon Wiesenthal Center, a Jewish human rights group, yesterday started a letter campaign to Internet access providers and universities asking them to refuse to carry messages that, quote, promote racism, anti-Semitism, mayhem, and violence, unquote. And so this group is calling for ethical rules of engagement on the net. What do you think of that?
I have mixed opinions. Obviously, I prefer if everybody were civil and didn't use the Internet for promoting hate group activities and so forth. But I'm a very strict First Amendment type of guy, and I really believe the attempts to restrict the type of information on the Internet will ultimately proved to be unsuccessful and unwise. Some of the hate groups are using encrypted messages, which gets beyond what a service provider can do anyway. So I understand the reasoning why they would want to do it. I just don't, I'm not sure that that's a wise idea.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kenneth Stern, and he's the American Jewish Committee's expert on hate groups and the author of a new book about the history of the militia movement and the politics of hate. It's called A Force Upon the Plain. You say that the militias don't define themselves as hate groups, but as citizens trying to reclaim and preserve a way of life under attack.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and that's not unique to them. If you look at the Ku Klux Klan, if you look at the Nation of Islam, you look at any sort of group that people might agree have a hateful agenda for one reason or another, people don't define that as hate. They define it as love of something. I mean, David Duke would say, I don't hate black people, I just love white folks. Or Louis Farrakhan would say, I don't hate white folks, I just love black folks. Well, these folks also don't see themselves as haters. They've sort of repainted the world into this sort of alternative reality where they and their guns are protecting the American way of life. They are the true patriots. They are the inheritors of Samuel Adams and George Washington. And the people in Washington, D.C. are the usurpers. They're serving these global interests. They're serving foreign masters. They're part of a new world order. And the militia members and their guns are the true patriots because they're going to defend everybody. So they don't see that as hate. They see it as an overt positive thing they're trying to do for society.
Well, is it taboo to express hate even in hate groups?
Well, I think people express hate but call it something else. And I think that's what happens inside these groups. There's a venomous hate of the federal government in particular. A lot of it comes from the strains of the old hate groups like the Posse Comitatus and the others that we knew from the 1980s that define the federal government as illegal and immoral. I mean, the basic premise of some of this stuff is something called Christian patriotism, which basically goes as follows, which is a little oversimplified, but it's like this, that white Christian males have all the rights they need under the Constitution and the first 10 amendments, which are divinely inspired, and you have to view them as scripture. The amendments after the first 10, things like income tax, but also votes for women, freeing the slaves, equal rights, and so forth, are ones that are man-made laws that are suspect. And those laws therefore create two different types of citizenship. So you have white Christian males are state citizens or sovereign citizens. Terry Nichols, by the way, described himself as a sovereign citizen and tried to renounce his U.S. citizenship. So did John Trockman. But then you have minorities who are now 14th Amendment citizens because they did get their rights through the 14th Amendment. So they do have obligations like paying taxes and so forth. And if you read the Militia of Montana literature and some of the others in the militia movement, they put forward this type of fiction. Now, they don't say that that's hate. They just say that that's their, you know, analysis of constitutional law. And they'll get up in front of a Senate and say, you know, we defend the Constitution, but it's an entirely different type of Constitution. And in my book, that's hatred.
Today I printed out the Aryan Nation's homepage on the net, and I think something on here exemplifies what you're talking about how hate groups use love to the word love to justify their thoughts and actions. And this homepage says, what is the actual driving force behind the, quote, racist white Christian nationalist fight for the preservation of the Aryan race? You know, the message is love. The depths of love are rooted and very deep in a real white nationalist soul and spirit. No form of hate could even begin to compare, at least not a hate motivated by ungrounded reasoning. It's not hate that makes the average white man look upon a mixed racial couple with a scowl on his face and loathing in his heart. It's not hate that makes the white housewife throw down the daily juice paper in repulsion and anger after reading of yet another child molester or rapist sentenced by corrupt courts to a couple of short years in prison or on parole. And it goes on and on and on. And then it says, no, it is not hate, it's love.
Sure. And that's how the, you know, the message is spun. And most militia groups that may not have, you know, the overt connections to the Aryan Nations and so forth, still you get down in that funnel a little bit and you start seeing messages from groups like the Liberty Lobby or the Aryan Nations or Bogrites or the Posse Comitatus. And that type of culture breeds these types of theories where people actually see this as a manifestation of something positive.
My guest is Kenneth Stern, and he's the author of the new book, A Force Upon the Plain, The American Militia Movement and the Politics of Hate. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Kenneth Stern, the author of a new book on the American militia movement. You say that the militia of Montana was the first of these contemporary militias to form in the 90s. It was co-founded by John Trockman. Was this militia in response to Ruby Ridge and Randy Weaver?
Yeah, John Trockman was somebody who had a connection with Randy Weaver. The Trockmans knew the Weavers. Mrs. Trockman actually helped deliver the last Weaver child when they were in seclusion. The families, you know, they were part of the chain of folks that helped supply Randy Weaver when he was up on the mountaintop. And in the aftermath of the siege and the arrest of Randy Weaver, Trockman, with some others, started a defense committee for Randy Weaver, and that was the, you know, I think the genesis. There was also one of the people that was in the support group went to a meeting in October of 1992 in a place called Estes Park, Colorado, that was convened by a gentleman named Pete Peters, who's a big leader in something called the Christian Identity Movement, which basically believes that white Christians are the real Jews, that the people we know as Jews are the offspring of Satan, and that blacks and other minorities are, quote, mud people, pre-Adamic creatures that are sort of like beasts. And he held this meeting in the aftermath of the Ruby Ridge siege, and that was the first real discussion of the formation of militia movements. And somebody from Trockman's support group for Weaver was actually at this Pete Peters meeting. So there are a lot of connections between Trockman and Weaver, and Trockman and others who were supporting Weaver and the decision to start a militia movement.
You say that the militia of Montana became a clearinghouse for information on how to conduct war in America. What kind of literature have they been disseminating?
You know, if you're, you want it, they have it in terms of how to form a militia group, how to divide the cell structure so that people can carry out activities and not threaten the existence of the whole group. I mean, for example, you get a group of 3 to 5 to 7, then it splits off and forms another group. You have 2 or 3 generations. Nobody knows who was in the original group, how to build all sorts of ordnance and, gun material and so forth. All that was available from their very extensive catalog, including audio tapes, government surplus catalogs. I mean, you want it, they had it.
What are the militias you're tracking most closely now?
I still look very closely at the militia of Montana. The people in Michigan have somewhat changed. Norman Olson left the Michigan militia because he said it was getting a little bit too mainstream for him and starting out another group. But I also sort of watch the movement as a whole. And what interests me even more than that in the aftermath of the bombing than the groups has been the reaction of others to these groups. I mean, it amazes me that we live in a society where people have had horrible experiences just living next door to these militia groups. I mean, just think about it. If you're in Montana, you're in Michigan, and there are these armed folks in the community who brag about having these heavy weapons and are taking on government. They've threatened local officials, including their kids in many places. They've poisoned the atmosphere where people are no longer feel comfortable showing up for public meetings because some folks have been threatened with ropes and threatened with guns. They no longer feel easy about sending letters to the editor or running for public office. Is a real caustic effect on democracy. And it seems to me that regardless of a group's political agenda, there ought not to be in America such a thing as a private army, regardless what their political agenda is. It's a dangerous, dangerous thing. America is not Somalia. We shouldn't have people that have a political agenda and their own, you know, formations with guns trying to figure out what to do about it in terms of combating local officials or government officials or whatever. But Congress has not even really looked at this. There was one hearing that the Republicans held back in November that I testified at along with some others, and that was only after a lot of yelling and screaming by Charles Schumer from the Democratic side of the aisle saying, how could you run and have these large-scale hearings on Waco and Ruby Ridge and not even talk about the militia movement?
What kind of legislation are you recommending?
I'm recommending a federal law that outlaws the existence of private armies, period. It seems to me that people have a First Amendment right to say whatever they please about government. People have rights consistent with the Second Amendment and how it's been interpreted in terms of gun ownership. But there ought not to be in America the ability to form a private army and practice and to plan sabotage and so forth. And that ought to be outlawed. And it ought to be a federal law, because there are state laws on the books around the country and they have not been enforced. And I think it's understandable. And put yourself in a position of somebody out in Montana who may have a deputy or two. How do you go and arrest an army? How do you go try them in a community? It's a federal problem that needs a federal answer. And I think until another tragedy occurs, or maybe a couple of tragedies, people are not going to get that message.
What are some of the other dilemmas you think local law enforcement officials have faced?
Well, they've been threatened. They have the fear that their kids may be killed. I mean, I know of a judge in Montana who's just basically a traffic court judge. And she had the problem of having some of these militia-linked folks come into her court. They, again, believed in some of these Christian patriot ideas. How could the court have jurisdiction over them? They're a sovereign citizen. And they basically talked about threatening, taking her and bringing her into their own common law court, trying her for treason, and executing her, because that's death is the penalty for treason. They threatened that if they couldn't get her, they'd get her kids. And she actually had the police come by and instruct her which house to hide in, which room in her house to hide in to have the best chance of surviving a barrage. I know another county attorney who had these folks say they're not even going to build a gallows when they try him. They're just going to let him swing from the bridge. Even beyond these folks, federal officials, forest rangers, Bureau of Land Management folks. I know somebody who had not only himself threatened, but they were going to threaten to take his 12-year-old kid and throw him down a well. And when asked about what is the most difficult part about your job as a forest ranger, a federal employee, he said, well, it's learning to keep your head down.
Kenneth Stern, you are the hate group expert for the American Jewish Committee. And one of the things you do is track conspiracy theories. And you say, historically, Jews have not fared well around conspiracy theories. What are some of the current anti-Semitic code phrases that are being used in conspiracy theories?
Well, the basic premise comes out of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is the Tsarist forgery in the late 1800s. That basically, you think about it, how can people believe this? There are a group of old Jewish guys that got together in the woods and basically planned everything that happened of consequence in the world. Well, there are all sort of variations on that theme. So you hear...
I'm going to ask you to back up a second.
Sure.
I think a lot of us don't really understand what the Protocol of the Elders of Zion really is. Give us a short capsule of that.
Sure. Well, what happened was there was a French novel that basically had Napoleon as the subject of the book, and it was recast in a forgery that was promoted by the Tsar in the late 1800s that had Jews now as the subject of it. And Jews were supposedly this group that had these leaders that met in the woods and planned everything of consequence that would happen in the world.
So this was a novel recast as a nonfiction book telling the truth about the Jewish conspiracy.
And it got promoted in the United States by Henry Ford, of all people, got a copy of it and reprinted excerpts in the Dearborn Independent under something called the International Jew. I mean, it sold, millions of copies. And that was, pretty much a standard view of Jews by many folks, including those in hate groups. You could buy it today, by the way, from the Nation of Islam, which is why, Louis Farrakhan gets the people in the Jewish community very upset. But in any event, those ideas of basically it's like the Wizard of Oz. Somebody's behind the screen pulling the strings, making everything happen, has basically been the premise of the militia groups, that there is somebody behind the scene, whether it's called the New World Order or One World Government or international bankers or some of these other groups that they refer to, Trilateral Commission and others, that are pulling the strings and making decisions that are designed to control people's lives and, in fact, enslave them. So there's this whole view in the militia movement that gets very involved, these conspiracy theories. Not only is the New World Order out to get you, they're out to do things like put biochips in you so they can monitor you. They're out to put codes in your money so they can scan as they drive by your house to see how much money you have. They're out to put numbers on the back of road signs so that when they come to get you with these black helicopters or Gurkha troops or foreign troops or UN troops or whatever and come to take you away to a concentration camp, they'll know which concentration camp to take you to because the one that you're destined for corresponds with the number on the back of your local road sign. So it gets more and more involved, but it's basically the rock bottom view of this is the idea of the protocols. There's somebody out there making decisions in a small conspiracy that's going to impact your freedom and your life.
Kenneth Stern is the American Jewish Committee's expert on hate and hate groups. His new book on the American militia movement and the politics of hate is called A Force Upon the Plain. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more from Kenneth Stern on hate groups. We remember sculptor Dwayne Hansen, who died over the weekend at the age of 70. His lifelike sculptures are so real-looking that many museum-goers have tried to strike up conversations with them. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings of Mozart and Brahms sonatas. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kenneth Stern, the American Jewish Committee's expert on hate groups. He's written a new book on the American militia movement and the politics of hate called A Force Upon the Plain. The book decodes some of the conspiracy theories today's hate groups subscribe to. Now, a lot of people in militias and hate groups talk about the New World Order. Pat Robertson talks about the New World Order. He has a 1991 book outlining the New World Order and standing staunchly against it. What's the connection between Pat Robertson's view of the New World Order and the hate group view of the New World Order?
Well, I don't think it's that different from the way that Robertson describes it. The difference, I think, is in the practical application of the political agenda of the various groups. In other words, the Christian Coalition is not out to make war on the system. They're not out to blow up government officials or to, you know, plan for war or the inevitability of war. They're trying to take over the system. They want to take over the Republican Party, and they want to use it for their political agenda. The militia groups don't see anything worth trying to take over. They see their only option is in basically a civil war.
Do they both believe in the same thing when they talk about the New World Order?
I think it's a similar concept, but you read Robertson's book and the imagery is similar, but obviously it does not go into that the same extent as the militia groups do. And he also has other messages to sell as well. I mean, the overlap in terms of imagery, I'm frankly more concerned about than Robertson's, although I am somewhat concerned with his, is groups like the NRA. That have promoted the type of view of guns in American society, not as something that we can have a reasoned debate about people, should they have guns, shouldn't they have guns, what the Second Amendment means and does not mean. They've recast it into ownership of guns as the benchmark of liberty, and the government is jackbooted Nazis, they talk about, you know, at Waco and so forth, that are, you know, people that we have to be very, very concerned about because they're coming away to take away your freedom. Well, those type of overblown images and discussion about guns as a necessity of freedom plays right into the militia movement, gives them legitimacy, and it's not accidental that they're both pointing to the same misconstrued parts of the Second Amendment terminology to give themselves justification to say, we're not being, you know, anti-society, we're not being anti-federal government, we're not being anti-public official, we're just being patriots.
My guest is Kenneth Stern, and he's the expert on hate groups for the American Jewish Committee and the author of a new book on the American militia movement and the politics of hate. You track hate groups. What's your day-to-day work like tracking hate groups?
Well, that's only part of what I do. I sit at the domestic desk of the American Jewish Committee, and I'm responsible for our programming and reactions to all aspects of anti-Semitism, extremism, bigotry, including hate groups. So it's a very varied thing. Sometimes I feel like I'm doing triage, but, you know, it's either dealing with instances of bigotry on campus and meeting with college presidents to tell them about how, without curtailing free speech rights, how they should organize their campus so that people know what to do about bigotry and to have it pre-planned. Working with the media about anti-Semitism and racism and homophobia in the media. It's a very varied. I don't lack for interesting things to do.
When you're talking to university professors about the language of hate, how do you balance your concerns about racism on campus with your concerns for free speech?
Well, what I basically say is that I talk mostly to presidents, by the way, because I think that the leadership of the colleges it's a real critical factor. If the president is silent, it doesn't matter what anybody else does. And I tell them that they have to be outspoken about bigotry, that the people have a First Amendment right to say what they want, but they have their First Amendment rights too, and they should not be silent. They have to set a moral tone for the campus. I also tell them that they have to pre-plan, because bigotry will happen, an incident will happen sooner or later, and if they haven't thought out a response plan, how people could report it, what to do, think about the different models of how they want to react, they're just sort of fumbling along as time goes by. That's going to get worse. And that's the real dynamic in most of these instances. People don't know what to do, and everybody takes that as a tacit admission that they don't think that this is a problem when an ugly incident does occur. So that's one thing I tell them. And secondly, I said they have to really, you know, reform their campus in a way that looks at the issues of intergroup relations, how people are treating each other on a daily basis before there is an explosion. And in terms of the hate speech codes, I say to them, those things, you know, don't work. I don't even have to reach the constitutional questions. My training is as a constitutional criminal lawyer. I don't even have to reach those issues. These things don't work, and they're basically, I've concluded, a subterfuge for campuses now to say, look, we've dealt with the problem. We have this law that says you can't say hateful things on campus. It's much easier to pass that than to really try to impact human relations.
Are you ever threatened by hate groups because of the work you do?
Well, I've been lucky so far that I haven't had, you know, too many, but that's, I think, part of the, you know, the territory. That's always a concern, as it is, I think, with many officials. Frankly, I'll tell you, I feel much more secure today than if I were a Bureau of Land Management official sitting out someplace in Nevada, where there have been a number of instances with the Carson City, you know, Ranger Station got blown up back in March of last year, other types of instances like that. I feel much safer as you know, doing the type of work I'm doing than I would be a federal employee in many parts of the country.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I think, you know, in the book you suggest that a lot of forms of racism and anti-Semitism are, you know, pretty taboo in our society, but it's not taboo yet to hate federal workers.
Yeah, you know, it's a strange dichotomy. On one hand, it's a healthy thing, I think, in American history to sort of, you know, to yell about and bemoan government and so forth. But it's never taken the character in my memory where it sort of becomes personal, and that there's a transformation where people and communities now feel it's okay to ostracize members of the federal government. There are places in Burns, Oregon, for example. Jim Ridgway wrote column a long time ago about going out there and seeing signs that said this establishment does not serve federal employees. Well, nobody would tolerate that. There was a sign in Burns, Oregon, that said we don't invite in Jews or blacks or whoever. But about federal employees, that seems to be okay. And that to me is a very troubling message that people can tolerate that in the community.
What's at the top of your list of priorities now in terms of hate groups?
Still the militia movement, very much so. I'm fearful that we're going to see other things from people associated with the militias, whether it's a small group that decide to act out on something. Especially I think as the trial comes up with McVeigh and Nichols, there's going to be a lot more attention from the militia groups on the trial. They're going to see it as part of a conspiracy of government in one form or another to go after these folks, and that might be an occasion to watch them again very closely.
Kenneth Stern, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Kenneth Stern is the American Jewish Committee's expert on hate and hate groups. His new book on the American militia movement and the politics of hate is called A Force Upon the Plain. Coming up, we remember sculptor Dwayne Hansen. This is Fresh Air. Sculptor Dwayne Hansen died over the weekend of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He was 70. We're going to remember him with an interview recorded in 1990 when he was in Philadelphia for the opening of a retrospective at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. I once went up to a Dwayne Hansen sculpture and asked it a question. It was a life-size sculpture of a museum guard, which I thought was a real museum guard. I was hardly the first person to make such a mistake with a Dwayne Hansen sculpture. In fact, once a museum guard, after closing time, went up to a sculpture of a man and asked it to leave. When there was no response, the guard ended up calling the police. Hansen created the authentic shapes of his figures through body casts of his models. He had an uncanny eye for clothing his sculptures, doing their hair, and giving them the perfect props. Hansen told me he'd heard lots of stories about museum goers who'd confused his statues with real people.
They take on a life of their own, and then, I used to get a little upset about that because I consider my work sort of serious work, and then they take it, all the funny things happen, but this is part of dealing with it.
But your work isn't really about fooling people.
No, of course not. And it's about sculpture, first of all, and then communicating my ideas about the human condition in this society.
What I especially like about your work is that each piece seems to be a character study of that person. It's not just a realistic rendering where you go like, boy, that looks real. I mean, you stare at the person and you feel you have a sense of what their character is. And the character is given to you both from the facial expression and through the way you've combed their hair and found their clothes and painted their complexion.
That's well stated. I really... appreciate that. That's really what it's about. It's not exactly, well, it's, it has something to do with portraiture, but it goes beyond that. It goes examining the character, like you say, of the individual to express that alienation or frustration or that fatigue or that sort of emptiness or just immersed in their own thoughts in some way.
I know when I went into the museum, the first thing I started to do was, the first piece I saw was the two tourists, and I went up to them real close, closer than I'd get to any person. Mm-hmm. And I'm like looking at the pores in their face and, looking like the label on their shopping bag and, well, I wonder what camera that is. And, I'm really giving them not just the once-over, but I'm like inspecting, the hairs growing out of their hands and stuff. And I think this is something you've talked about, how we all really want to stare at people, but in real life there's a limit to how close you can get.
It's a taboo, really. And people can do that here and derive some enjoyment of really studying another person. Driving over here to the station today, I noticed a couple of sculptures that I'd like to do. There was a policeman at a construction site or whatever. You know, he had a big burly guy and with the blue shirt and the cap, you know, the uniform they have here in Philadelphia. And his arms are folded like he's really in an authoritative, you know, he's watching out that, you know, you better watch out. I mean, those things are imprinted on my brain for months, years sometimes. I thought, I got to do that. I got to get to do that.
When someone catches your attention and you know you want to do a sculpture of them, mm-hmm. what's the next step?
Well,
is that the way it works, that you see somebody who you want to do?
I have an idea in my head that mm-hmm. I've got, you know, a whole list of things that I think would be important to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have an idea of a baseball player now, and I get at the model. Model's coming down, and we take Polaroid shots in different positionings, and I pick the best one, and then the model stands in that position. We do molds of the legs and the body and the arms and the head. I have these molds that are filled with plastic material Bondo, body fillers that they use when you dent your car. The body shops fix your car with this stuff. I use that to cast the material into the out of the molds, and that's assembled. And the forms never come out right for me, so I improve them. Maybe the cheeks sunk in, or the nose got pressed in. I build up the nostrils. I fix around the eyes. I fix stuff that doesn't come around. That's, you know, that's the sculpturing.
Let's take one of the people in the current show, Queenie, who is mm-hmm. The janitor.
Yeah.
Was the woman who you actually cast a janitor herself? In other words, do you
no.
do you cast
sometimes
the person
sometimes they are
who,
what they are portrayed, but mm-hmm. but I'm usually more interested in the physical presence of that person, like mm-hmm. Acting in a play,
yeah.
playing a part.
So you cast somebody
yeah.
in the role,
but it probably derives from somebody I've seen like that,
right?
But I mean, you can't grab people off the street. I mean, especially when you're traveling around, and get them. So I get the next best solution to that.
You find
idea.
Someone who looks mm-hmm. like them.
Yeah, right.
Do you shop for clothes when it's time to dress one of your statues?
Oh yes, that's very important, and it's frustrating sometimes. Sometimes the models will give me clothes from their own wardrobe, you know, mm-hmm. things that they don't want or something that I can buy from them that I know that they'll fit, you know. And also, if they don't have the right attire, I go shopping, and if it's something colorful, I go to Kmart and get the right size, and something would be too, you know, wrong color, the right size but the wrong color. And I've shopped around for sometimes a week, and sometimes go to the Goodwill or in places where they sell used clothing to get that worn effect. So that's very important to, to get the right clothing, and sometimes frustrating too.
Do you ever take a statue with you to make sure that the clothes are going to fit?
No, I don't scare people, I think.
You must have learned a lot about complexions, painting complexions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The skin tone is to look like it's almost translucent. The coloring is just, we use a base coat and then a little bit airbrushing on top. Some of them are painted by hand, and they don't turn out quite as well. They have more of a makeup look. It's so delicate. And, you know, some complexions are more, little yellow, more yellow, and some more pink. And black people, there's a lot of yellow, a lot of red, and a lot of kind of a Mars brown color.
There's a self-portrait in your current show.
Yeah.
It's a self-portrait with model. And yeah. it's a sculpture of you at mm-hmm. what looks like a luncheonette table.
Right.
And sitting across the table from you is a woman in a blue and white checked house dress. The house dress is sleeveless, and in the back, her brassiere is sticking out through the sleeveless armhole.
You notice that?
Yeah. She's pretty overweight.
Yes.
She's reading Arthritis magazine and eating a sundae. There's a copy of Woman's Day sitting on the table mm-hmm. also. Tell me about the scene that this comes from.
Well, I wanted to do a self-portrait, and I didn't want to do an ordinary kind where, in art history, you see the artist holding a brush, obviously looking into a mirror and painting himself, and a sculptor carving out something. I wanted to be portrayed as an observer because that's what I do, basically, more than anything else, and that the work is derived from that. You know, every artist has to do a self-portrait sooner or later, or wants to do it, or I'm sort of glad I did it.
You were, I think, about 42 when you started doing realist sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
Were you doing mostly abstraction before that?
No, I never really got into it. I never felt comfortable with doing abstraction work. It was representational work. You could see it was a figure. It was modified to, you know, maybe design. Maybe the features weren't all there, but the part of the character was there. Part of the composition was there. It was carved out of wood or stone or modeled in clay. And I came to the conclusion that so what? You know, I do this and can do this. But it doesn't really say anything about the human condition. These are works by themselves, each individual one. You have to have sort of a concept of a body of work that will convey, communicate some ideas, some concepts which you have in your head, I think. And that's what I got into when I got into realism and when pop art came to be accepted and then realism seemed to be legitimate again. I got into it, and then one thing led to another. I did 67, I guess it was, a group of four dead shoulders and one dying to express my protests about the war in Vietnam. I did a race riot, about five sculptures in that, and then moved to New York in 1969. I did a group of derelicts off the Bowery. And then that evolved into more critical types with my first tourists and dressed out in rather outlandish attire, a supermarket shopping lady with her cart. And now I do more illusionistic types, not so much manipulating of exaggeration and so on of the subject.
When I look at your sculptures, I feel like I recognize everybody. I've seen people who I know or who I've met who are very much like them. I wonder if you feel sometimes in art that we're still not quite at the point where a lot of just like real people, ordinary people, are represented. I mean, I wonder if you still feel that mostly in art people are still idealized.
Oh, I think you're right, yeah. And I think that's one of the major attractions to my work, that these are people that they've seen, that they know, that they recognize, and that they really have come to light.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Dwayne Hansen recorded in 1990. He died Saturday at the age of 70 of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says it's all too rare these days to find classical music played in a style that balances classical refinement with real feeling. But he's found a couple of recordings that do just that. Here's his review. Thank you.
This is one of those, I was in my car and heard something on the radio and couldn't believe my ears stories. It's an, I could tell instantly what a wonderful performance this was going to be story. And it's also a, where have you been all my life story. The music was Mozart, and one of the performers was the Portuguese pianist Maria João Pires, who is one of those widely respected musicians I've heard and admired, but somehow never followed up on. For several years, a car injury interrupted her career. The other was the French violinist Augustin Dumay, who was new to me. They're now a team, and I gather, an item. I hope they're as happy together as they've made me. The recording I heard on the car radio was a Mozart violin sonata. There's a horrible way of performing Mozart, which is practically the only way you get to hear Mozart these days. It implies that 18th century classical music is all a little tinkly and precious, that it doesn't mean anything, so everything sounds the same. What makes Pires and Dumay stand apart is that they don't play just notes, but phrases, and they're not afraid to vary their tone, so the phrases have a voice behind them, even feeling. The two instruments are on speaking terms, they're in conversation, and because they aren't speaking words but music, we're also overhearing their innermost thoughts. None of this speaking quality would be worth much if it didn't also have the elegance and refinement of the classical style. What's most moving about Mozart is the restraint that holds in check, but never hides, the real, sometimes tragic emotion underneath. Pires and Dumay have also recorded Brahms sonatas with the same human qualities. Brahms has the opposite problem from Mozart, though. His music is too often forced into overdrive. Here, Pires and Dumay are, appropriately, more openly passionate than in Mozart, but they're equally interior, not merely extroverted, and never vulgar.
Thank you.
These recordings have been around for several years, which means they must be doing pretty well. But classical albums that are not runaway bestsellers have a way of disappearing. I just wanted to call them to your attention before it's too late.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed albums of Mozart and Brahms sonatas by Maria Joao Pires and Augustin Dumay on the Deutsche Grammophon label. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, Joyce Lieberman, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the sacred music of Haitian voodoo. We talk with Liza McAllister, who has studied voodoo culture in Haiti and New York and produced a new CD of voodoo ceremonial music. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.